On the 4th of this month, the White House published its National Security Strategy, a document normally created once per presidential term. The contents of this one were so radical and departed so far from previous strategies that the gasps of alarm and, from some unlikely places, the sighs of relief must have been audible from outer space. Just as the Trump tariffs have threatened to turn world trade on its head, so this strategy is seen as upending the whole system of post-war alliances. So, does it? And what does it mean for the world and for us in the UK? Step into the last briefing room of 2025 and together we'll find out. First, I'm joined by the BBC security correspondent Frank Gardner. Frank Gardner, what is this document, the National Security Strategy?
It's a very important document, and it's one that's been quite surprising, certainly for people in Europe, because it is a complete departure from previous US national security strategies. The last one that Donald Trump's presidency issued was in 2017. And what it does is it sets out the presidency or the White House's view of the world and what it sees as the challenges, priorities, and in the past, the threats. Although, strangely, this document doesn't, unlike previous documents, depict Russia and China as threats to the United States. If anything, it depicts Europe's current trajectory as the threat. It talks about Europe being threatened with civilizational erasure because of its lax immigration policies. And there is no mention of Russia being a threat. China only gets a few mentions and is really talked about in terms of an economic competitor, but not as a threat.
Now, what is the document for? What's its purpose? I suppose I should also ask, who is it for?
It's for everybody, friend and foe of America, and also for domestic consumption. It's a guide to the way America sees the world during this presidency. It's drawn up by the US cabinet, but I think some would say it also has J.D. Vance, the vice president's, stamp on it. And I think to some extent it is a written sort of follow-on to the speech that the US Vice President J.D. Vance gave at Munich. I was there for it in February this year at the Munich Security Conference, which shocked a lot of people because everybody thought he was going to talk about NATO, about Russia, about Ukraine, instead of which he absolutely lambasted Europe for what he called its suppression of free speech and its lax immigration policies.
So how is it structured? How many pages and roughly how is it divided?
Well, it's 33 pages, which, you know, frankly, compared to some government documents, is not that long. And it's been criticised for having some holes in it, for being slightly inconsistent in places. Essentially, the US is less interested in Europe, according to this document, than it is in the Americas, the Caribbean, Latin America, and Eastern Pacific. It really kind of excoriates Europe's leaders and talks about America's priorities being to encourage those movements that challenge the existing order in Europe. This has got a lot of head scratching in Europe because this questions, of course, America's commitment to the liberal world order, to NATO, to democracies, to its allies, such as Macron, Starmer, Merz, you know, Europe's main allies. So it's a very strange document in that sense. But it doesn't necessarily mean that all its objectives are going to be put into practice.
So how does this strategy document differ from previous strategy documents?
It's very clear that this document is very different from all previous US administrations, including even the first Trump presidency, because in that one, in Trump 1.0, he was certainly moderated and tempered by what some people would call the grown-ups, generals like Jim Mattis, H.R. McMaster, Rich Tillerson, people like that. Those people aren't around today. And in that sense, it's a bit more of an extreme view and one that is going to rattle European leaders, I think, quite a lot more.
Frank Gardner, before we go on, a quick reminder about the Briefing Room podcast. If you visit BBC Sounds, you can find the entire back catalogue, such as the one which looks at why there's been a problem for young doctors trying to get specialist training, and the one about what the US military is up to off the coast of Venezuela. Now, back to the US national security strategy and what it means for all of us. I'm joined on the line by Rebecca Lissner, who's a senior fellow for US foreign policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. She's worked in senior national security and foreign policy roles in the White House, most recently under the Biden administration. Shashank Joshi, who's defense editor of The Economist, and Christoph Heusgen, former German diplomat and former chair of the Munich Security Conference, which is an annual conference on international security policy. Shashank Joshi, can you remind us what was actually said in this document about Europe?
I think the really interesting thing is that it overturns the traditional assumption about American grievances, which is that Europe is too dependent on America, doesn't spend enough on defense. And the document says, well, that's true, but that's not the main issue. And the main issue to which it devotes many pages is the risk of what it calls civilizational erasure, by which it means some of the usual grievances that were offered by J.D. Vance, the vice president, in his Munich speech that we've discussed, David. But most of all, it's about, I think, cultural change. It says specifically, and this is a national security document, remember, that there are certain NATO countries that within a few decades, quote, will become non-European. By that, I read brown and black. So this is exporting some of these, you know, fringe ideas of racial cultural change from migration and saying Europe is at risk of destroying itself. It also says that America will unabashedly celebrate the rise of, I guess, what they would describe as sort of patriotic parties, by which they mean the Reform Party in the UK, they mean the RN in France, led by Jordan Bardella, Marine Le Pen, and of course, perhaps most troublingly of all, the AfD, the Alternative für Deutschland in Germany, which is a party that is, you know, quite pro-Russian, far-right, very anti-migration. And so in totality, what you have is a document that nowhere describes Russia as a threat or a competitor, although it does say the aim is to prevent the domination of Europe by any adversary, but devotes most of its space really criticizing European partners and describing them as countries in the midst of civilizational self-destruction. And all of that, I think, is unprecedented and fairly extraordinary.
Right. Now, Christoph, you were chair of the Munich Security Conference when Vice President J.D. Vance gave that speech. How redolent of that speech is this document?
Well, Shashanka has said it correctly. What we are having in black and white now with the national security strategy, we heard by J.D. Vance in Munich. And it was shocking. It was shocking because it departs from traditional American policy. You have to know that the Munich Security Conference was actually constructed on a transatlantic basis. It was constructed during the Cold War, transatlantic unity, fighting off Stalin, fighting off the Russians. And now all of a sudden, you have an American president and you have an American vice president that criticizes that and wants to have a strategic stability with Russia and criticizing European democracy.
Rebecca, you're in the US. What's your reading of what this national security strategy says about Europe? And I suppose in the first instance, I should ask, are you surprised by it?
I was surprised to see this language in the national security strategy, and it marks a sea change in American foreign policy. Really, since the end of the Cold War, we've seen a United States of America that has tried to build a liberal international order. But what this national security strategy says is that the United States actually now seeks to build an illiberal international order. And that impulse is really clearest in the discussion of Europe, which exactly, as Shashank just said, goes beyond the sort of now familiar calls for allies to spend more on their own defense, to stop free riding on U.S. security, and says something quite different, something much more ideological. And what's new here is actually the affirmative call for political interference in Europe in support of right-wing anti-EU parties. It calls for the U.S. to correct Europe's political trajectory.
Shashank, very recently, in one of Putin's most recent speeches, he's talked about how there may only be peace in Ukraine once Europe's current politicians have been replaced, political elites have been replaced. There is a kind of, I don't know, a kind of congruence of language here between what Putin is saying, isn't there, and what's in this document?
Well, one of the most striking things was to see the Kremlin say that it was very much in alignment with this national security strategy, which is, again, a completely unprecedented thing to hear about any major US security document. So practically, ideologically, intellectually, I think there is a clear alignment between many, many Russian objectives and those of the Trump administration when it comes to the future political shape and attitude of Europe. And the language in the NSS, David, is about things like strategic stability with Russia. Of course, on the face of it, that's a good thing. No one wants strategic instability with Russia. But the fear is that what this means is a highly favorable peace to Russia that meets many of its demands, for example, on rolling back NATO membership from members who were in Eastern and Central Europe.
How do you read how the document casts any potential conflict between Europe and Russia, or the relationship going forward between the United States and Russia?
I think it casts it in the sense that says there need not be any natural conflict, that if Russia is given what it wants in Ukraine, that you can achieve strategic stability. It says that specifically this document and the US policy should end all talk of expanding NATO any further, which is music to Russia's ears. And if you do those things, you can have a sensible, grown-up and stable relationship with the Kremlin. And the implicit belief, although this is not articulated, is that it's aggressive and bellicose Europeans who are fighting to the last Ukrainian, who are pressing against Russia, that are the cause of this conflict. And if you can settle that problem, you can essentially calm things down. And therefore, America doesn't need to have a large presence in Europe. It doesn't need to risk American lives in Europe. It can get on with all the other things the document says to do with the Pacific and to do with the Western Hemisphere.
Rebecca, we were talking about one aspect of Donald Trump's policy, which is deal-making. Is there any suggestion in this that there are commercial advantages for America to be had in getting this other relationship with Russia?
There is no question that at the end of the day, President Trump wants normalization of the relationship between the United States and Russia. That means lifting sanctions, and that means resuming commercial relationships. From the president's perspective, Ukraine is a nuisance. This is not the frontier of the fight for the free world. This is an issue that he would really like to be able to put to the side so that he can pursue what has been a longstanding objective for President Trump, which is to have a good relationship with Putin and to have a good U.S.-Russia relationship. Now, that being said, I do think it's worth noting that this is one of the areas that President Trump's 2025 national security strategy does dramatically depart from what he put on paper in his first national security strategy in 2017. Now, that strategy was very clear that great power competition with China and Russia was going to be the orienting goal of American foreign policy. So this is a dramatic walk back, even from what President Trump said was American strategy in his first administration versus now. And the last thing I would say is that as the talks continue over what any kind of Ukraine deal, ceasefire, peace settlement could look like, if I were the Ukrainians, I would be very skeptical about even the most strongly worded U.S. security guarantees when we know that at the end of the day, this administration really seeks strategic stability and normalized relations with Russia.
Christoph, let's talk in practical terms about what Europe may need to do in order to adjust to an American policy which may be based on this strategic document. I mean, it may or may not be, but in the future, but let's presume it may be.
Yes, I mean, I take up what Rebecca just said about American security guarantees and what they are worth. And what holds true for security guarantees that the Americans may embark upon with regard to Ukraine, it holds true for NATO as well. Yes, we had a commitment to NATO at the last summit by the US, but can we rely on that? No. We Europeans have to get our act together. We have to get a credible defense. We, I think, are on a good track there. We're doing a lot. Is it enough yet? No, it's not. But it has to sink in with everybody that what we have taken for granted for many decades is that the Americans will always be there if need be, that this is no longer a given.
Shashank, we've had some quite interesting speeches made here in Britain recently, not least by the head of MI6. And the suggestion seems to be that the powers that be are taking all this pretty seriously. How seriously are we taking it? And what do we need to do in order to meet the scale of the potential challenge?
Well, I think there's an interesting debate in the system that everyone agrees Russia is a threat. But I think there's a question over whether you should be talking in the terms that Mark Rutte has, the NATO Secretary General, who says, look, if you don't start spending 5% of GDP on defense, you may as well start learning Russian. He says Russia could attack within 5 years. You've then got the view that I think was advanced by the chief of defense staff until recently here, Tony Radakin, who said in a speech last year, at the end of the day, we're getting a little bit over the top. Yes, Russia's a threat, but it's bogged down in Ukraine. It would lose and lose very badly if it started a war today, and deterrence is broadly stable. And of course, we have countries with nuclear weapons. So there's a debate over the timeline of the threat, I think. But the other question here is in the UK that people are noticing this clear gap, this chasm, really, between the threat perception as outlined by the likes of Rich Knighton, the chief of defence staff, and Blaise Metrowelli, the head of MI6, saying Russia's an acute threat, and the fact that our defence spending commitments, unlike those of Germany, which is really impressive, are backloaded into the 2030s. And in fact, next year, in 2026, defence spending is going to be very, very tight. There may have to be cuts. And so that chasm between warnings and between spending, I think, is beginning to look very strange to lots of people in Whitehall and in the British national security state.
OK, I think we want to move on now to another area of the world. Rebecca, what does the strategy document say about what used to be seen as America's backyard?
Well, I think it's still very much seen as America's backyard if you read President Trump's national security strategy. But this document is notable because of its overwhelming focus on the Western Hemisphere. And here, really, we mean Latin America. The focus isn't really on Canada. But the national security strategy elevates the Western Hemisphere as America's highest priority. It places a great emphasis on the need to stop migration to the United States, the need to combat what the president calls narco-terrorists or drug traffickers. And even today, we see something on the order of 10,000 American troops and significant military power and assets massed in the Western Hemisphere, in the Caribbean. And this is a signal of where they think our defense priorities should be in the future, and likely what's to come when the Pentagon releases its own national defense strategy, likely over the next month or so.
I'm trying to understand this. Does this document seriously suggest that America should have more control and influence over the policies of countries such as Brazil?
Absolutely. And earlier we were talking about the ways in which the United States could in the future attempt to influence European politics. Well, we've actually seen several test cases of that in Latin America over the course of 2025. For example, ahead of the Argentine midterm elections, President Trump agreed to a $40 billion bailout of Argentina in an attempt to help his friend, President Milei, do well in the midterm elections. And it seems to have worked. In Brazil, President Trump attempted to stop President Lula from imprisoning former President Bolsonaro with the threat of 50% tariffs. That didn't work, and Bolsonaro is now in prison, but Trump certainly tried. And most recently, we saw President Trump intervene in the Honduran elections. He accused there of being election fraud, and he also released from prison a former Honduran president who had been convicted for drug charges in the United States. So to me, this is already an assertion of U.S. privilege, dominance, and in many ways coercion in the Western Hemisphere in an attempt to shape political outcomes. And I think it shows a playbook that could be taken globally if the president really wanted to invest in building an illiberal coalition around the world to include in Europe.
Christoph, you're not just an expert on Europe. You've looked at other things as well. How would you regard the chances of such a strategy succeeding?
Well, I think Rebecca has put it right. He has succeeded in some ways already, but overall, he will not succeed. What we have is Brazil. I see that just as in Canada, U.S. Politics, U.S. interference led to the victory of an anti-Trumpist. I think the same will hold true for Brazil, and Brazil is the most important partner. They will do some accommodation for economic reasons, but I don't see that in the 21st century, you can go back to the 19th century. This will not work out. The Latin Americans are proud people. They don't want to become a colony from the US. And Rebecca mentioned the freeing of the Honduran, former Honduran president. I mean, on the one hand, the president says from morning to night, we have to deal with narco trafficking, etc. And then he releases a guy who was responsible for major narco trafficking. So there is no logic behind that. The only logic is he wants to dominate, and in particular for economic reasons. Business people, this is a government, we must not forget this, of people who have business interests, and they want to secure this business interests, which we just see playing out in Venezuela.
Shashank, who might America want to exclude from Latin America?
Well, we've already established this administration doesn't see Russia as a major threat, let alone a competitor. And therefore, it won't shock you to learn that the principal concern is China. And of course, Chinese activity, including strategic activity, things like building space radars or listening posts in the Americas, those were things that would have concerned the Biden administration, as I'm sure Rebecca can attest. The difference, I think, is in the response to this. There's one line that really stuck out at me. It says, "The terms of our agreements, especially those with countries that depend on us most and over which we therefore have the most leverage, must be sole source contracts for our companies, and we should make every effort to push out foreign companies that build infrastructure in the region." Obviously, the Panama Canal was a major recent incident of this, where involvement of a Chinese company provoked the Trump administration. But I think you will see this across all South American states.
We've mentioned China, so let's now look at China. What does this national security strategy tell us about how the US views China, Rebecca?
This is a dramatic retreat from where the first Trump administration was in its focus on great power competition with China. And it really underscores the reality that in the first Trump term, he was surrounded by China hawks, who really led a shift in American policy towards a much more hawkish, much more competitive approach to Beijing. And that was an approach, frankly, that continued on in large part through the Biden administration. But now President Trump is walking back from that focus on great power competition with China. He says that what this is really about is the commercial and economic relationship. And the paramount goal is, in the words of the national security strategy, a, quote, mutually advantageous economic relationship with Beijing, unquote.
Shashank, what about Taiwan? We've made programs about Taiwan and whether or not China would be seriously interested in invading Taiwan. Is the logic of this document the one that we've been speaking about, which is Russia can have Ukraine, we can have Latin America, and maybe therefore China can have Taiwan?
I think there were some fears the Trump administration might say that they might sort of do a deal with China over other issues. In fact, I think the document is fairly clear on this. It says we will maintain our longstanding policy, which means the US does not support any unilateral change to the status quo. I think what's interesting, though, is the reason it supports Taiwan. It says it's partly about semiconductors, but also about its location in the Pacific. There's nothing in there about Taiwan's status as a democracy, which is very much fitting with the administration's broader sense of, you know, apart from Europe, we're not going to get into the politics and ideologies of these other countries. I think the other thing, though, is here is where we must reflect on the gap between what's written in a strategy document and what really happens. Because, of course, there is a lot of rhetoric on competition with China, on upholding the status quo in Asia. But then allies who are thinking about the future of Taiwan will be looking carefully at decisions by the Trump administration, such as the recent one to sell some of the most advanced chips produced by US manufacturers to China, essentially for economic benefit, regardless of the effect it may have on China's AI capabilities and tech competition. And so if you were the Philippines, or if you were Australia or Japan, asking, will the Americans really defend Taiwan? I think you would still be pretty hazy on where US policy is going on China in the long run. And you would think that economic trade, economic cooperation is still a bigger priority than deterrence at this stage.
Which brings me on to this last question to you, Christoph. The question which I suspect a lot of people will be asking is, will this document outlast the present president? In other words, would a change of administration, and whatever kind of change of administration that would be, quite possibly lead to a reversal to many of its major provisions?
Well, of course, it's an important document, but let's not overestimate it. the U.S. administration have to turn out every 4 years a new national security strategy. They put a lot of things there. When you look at that in detail, you see that there were, you know, several authors there. I think when you read it, you feel actually this is some of these things are contradicting each other. So it is a confirmation of the transactional nature of the U.S. government. You have some ideologues who wrote there. Trump is going to remain transactional, and let's see what happens. I don't think that in 4 years they will only relate to this one, but in 4 years there will be a different document. So let's not take it too seriously. Let's take serious what we are witnessing in terms of American foreign policy, what they're doing left and right, and this has to concern us.
Rebecca, as the person on the spot, what's your estimate about whether or not this document has survivability?
Well, look, I think Christoph is right that this is not a document that will be referred to in the Situation Room as a guide to any specific policy choices. Now, the White House didn't roll out this national security strategy with the speech by the president or by the National Security Advisor, which is a break with recent tradition. They released it on the website late at night without very much fanfare. So I do question how much stock the White House is intending to put in this document. But nevertheless, it reflects, I might say, a vibe in the White House and in Washington. It captures key ideological currents within this administration, and it elevates them. So we are going to start to hear this rhetoric echoed as an element of U.S. messaging, because a lot of bureaucrats who work in the national security bureaucracy don't know what the president wants. So they will look to this document as guidance to frame what they write in their policy memos or to write a speech for their boss. And that's the main way that I think it will matter in filtering through the U.S. government. Now, how much will it matter for the future of American foreign policy? I do believe that especially the Europe elements here represent the MAGA turn in American grand strategy. And if we were to see a President J.D. Vance in the future, I do think that this is what his foreign policy would broadly look like. Now, it's also very possible that in January 2029, we'll have a Democratic president or a more traditional Republican president who would likely repudiate many key elements of this document. But at the same time, I think after 4 years of Donald Trump, we should not expect to see a reversion to a Biden-like foreign policy. So the point is that this NSS may not be a predictor of where U.S. foreign policy is going in the short or even medium term, but it is also the case that there is no going back to the way things were before President Trump took office for a second time in January.
That's all we've got time for. My thanks to Rebecca Lissner, Shashank Joshi, Christoph Heusken, and Frank Gardner. And that's the last programme in the current series. We'll be back in February. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Caroline Bailey, Kirstine Knight and Cordelia Hemming. The production coordinator was Maria Ogundeli. The sound engineer was Neil Churchill. And the editor was Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon. In the meantime, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Hello, I'm Sean Farrington, presenter of the BBC Radio 4 series Toast, which looks at amazing brands that promised a lot, yet somehow ended up toast. We're back with another series kicking off with a treat. Sir Stephen Fry on his disappointment when the BlackBerry smartphones he loved took a turn for the worse.
It was badly designed and the haptic click noise was hideous. It sounded like a dislocated knuckle.
Among our other topics is Skype. Why couldn't it capitalise on the popularity of video calling during the pandemic? And a bottled water from Coca-Cola, big in the States, but it sank here within just 6 weeks. Listen to Toast first on BBC Sounds.